Thank you very much. So this is a paper you... I'm terrible pronunciation is going to be forthcoming in this session, so please bear with me. Yu Haisang, just last year, finished his PhD studies with Donald McKenzie up in Edinburgh. We got talking, we decided to try and get at least one of his chapters into some sort of journal article, and this is part of its journey, so I'm very grateful for any comments or feedback and the chance to present it in the first place. So he studied non-professional or lay stock traders, as he calls them, in Taiwan. It's very interesting. It's very interesting because it's very popular. There are 87 brokerage accounts per 100 head of population. So, I mean, that really is an extraordinarily high amount. Everybody's up to it. Historically, we know from the finance quants that the performance of non-professional investors is pretty bad. We know that in the UK, we know that in the States. We also know that in Taiwan, that these studies have been done. So there's a kind of persistent problem of what's going on? Why do people keep investing when they're losing money? Why don't they do something else? And we have a sense of some of those answers, some of those problems, and more broader discussions of what exactly these people get up to in Anglo-Saxon context. So we know a little bit about American investors, we know a bit about UK investors, Australian investors, and so forth. There's a lot of commonalities between all of these. But it seems rather less relevant to what's going on in the data that Yu Haisang collected. Particularly because, I mean, I'm really trying to avoid some kind of Hofstadter, you know, collective versus individual or whatever, but nonetheless, there does seem to be a lot of that going on. Inasmuch as what we see in the language, the discussions of non-professional investors in the UK, for example, well, I did my PhD on that. These people, they tend to be individual investors, they're quite isolated, they're nearly all male, like 80 or 90% male. The language they use, they kind of talk about, it's a sort of professional kind of language. They talk about science, about reason, about systems. You know, it's kind of work. It's all sort of very masculine. Except, of course, when it comes to actually talking about how much money they've lost. And then they all get together and they sort of commiserate collectively about how the systems mould them all. And if they get all the, you know, the big players mould them all. And if they get their systems better, you know, they're going to make lots of money. So there's this kind of idea going on. And also, in terms of the literature you might use to frame, to think about this stuff. I mean, throughout the morning, and as Liz mentioned, we've had these various approaches. The European anthropology of calculation fits very well to talk about what's going on in the Anglo-Saxon context, in as much as it's all about abstraction framing. It's about, you know, you leave your family commitments, you go and sit in your spare bedroom and you fire up all your screens and you do kind of stuff with science, and somehow that makes you money or doesn't. Clearly, that is not what is going on in Taiwan. So the question is, what is? Now, when Yu Haisang wrote his dissertation, he framed it very much within a sort of Granovetterian embeddedness social relations type economic sociology. And there's something to be said for that, but it's also clear that there's quite a lot more going on as well. So the question is, what can we do to get a grip on some of that? And the place that it appeared to be sensible to start is this notion of relational work, which again we've talked about already this morning. This is kind of new to me, actually. I've been aware of this stuff and I've read some of it, but I haven't ever engaged with it or used it in any academic work before. But it does seem to speak very well to what's going on in the data that we have. That the investors, the are doing, they're doing stuff. The notion that economic activity is somehow constituent of other kinds of social relations and the way that we organise and organise, speak about where we put our money, how we earmark or whatever, that this actually shapes the family settings or whatever that we find ourselves in, exactly as we heard this morning, is very, very appropriate here. So earmarking strategies, of course, the notion that comes up in Caitlin Zloom's work, that speculative money needs to be somehow separated from its reference of domestic life, that it's very hard to gamble with your grocery bill, that you walk into the casino, you're given these chips, they are for gambling with, and they're therefore losable. Zelitzer says we should pay attention to what she calls it creativity and constraint. It's politics and power, you know, who gets to design what earmarking goes where. These other notions of relational schemes that we can use, so communal authority, quality, market pricing and so forth, and an idea of blurring and clarification strategies that people use to negotiate this kind of work. So anyway, that gives us a kind of framework, at least, that we can try and get to grips with some of this data. So, now, I'm not even going to try some of this stuff. But the language, spoiled my punchline. The language is important here. So stock investing is described as this a movement for all people. So it's democratic. It's not at all elitist. In the UK, for example, these people are wanting to be like the professionals. They're wanting to take on the professionals of their own game. This is quite the reverse. This is something you have to be involved in this, or you're left out. And stock market chatter, I like this, is popper mama, which literally means mother-in-law. It's kind of like woman's gossip. So you sit around a little bit of revenge for all this morning's sessions coming. Sit around having a cup of tea and your piece of cake and talking about what's happened in the stock market. So there's an immediate gendering, that's my point, of this kind of investing. Stir-frying stock, I love that. In China, it means trading. In Taiwan, it's got a slightly more suspicious connotation. It means manipulating the markets. But whatever it is, it's a kitchen metaphor, it's a domestic metaphor. It's got this notion of kind of ceaseless activity, moving the stuff around, which gives us an idea of the sort of frequency of trading. It's very nice. And again, we have these elision between playing stock and the words for to play a game, and doing stock where you do business. So stock investing, whatever it is, isn't a kind of rational, disembodied, scientific thing in the way that it is in the West. It's something domestic, it's popular, it's gendered, it's something that is kind of liminally business, non-business, whatever. So lots of interesting stuff going on there. Now, this is a great quote. Comes from, why do you start? So again, initially, analysing this material through a kind of social relations embeddedness perspective, simply says, well, people get involved in the market because they know other people who are involved in the market. But there's more going on here. Clearly, there are higher status actors, authority figures who have sort of charismatic authority or whatever, for various reasons, using these kind of discourses to sustain their authority. So Mrs. Zeng's next-door neighbour, who's made a lot of money in the market, says to her, you're too poor, so you have to do stock trading. I said, I don't know how to. I didn't know it could make a profit. Or the college student, you know, the star college student, who pays his whole fees. At that time, this was the king of shares. Its price was growing to over $600 in our college period. I had a friend in the graduate school who'd staked on this. It's his time in college. He earned back all his 4 years' tuition fees. I don't know if I had to do something. I quite like the slightly garbled translations that you have saying is produced, but we have to sort of get the sense out of it. It seems incredible that his graduate school tuition fees were sponsored by this company as well. So again, Mr. He saves up a bit of money and goes into the stock market. Now, in another very nice example, Mr. Yan is a new arrival in an elite postgraduate school. Everyone else in his cohort has been there as an undergraduate. So he's there's this. They're referred to as kind of pure blood whatevers. So he's an outsider, he's stuck. but they're all very keen on trading. And so he becomes a trader, and he becomes very good at it, and this is kind of his ticket into this elite status group all of a sudden. Actually, what happens is that he makes a bit of money, and then he loses it, loses a great deal of money, and then he's in a very difficult position because he can't admit that he's lost all the money. So he's trying to recoup his stock and maintain his position in this, in this particular environment. Now, one of the things that I haven't got to the bottom of in this data properly is that I think what happened is that Yu Haisang went home and interviewed his friends and people he knew. So I think that we have a sample of affluent middle-class investors, affluent educated middle-class investors, because what also seems to be going on in this data is preservation of family and status through stock trading. Whoops. So, again, we have a sense that this is everybody in the family is doing it. And it would be very strange if I didn't do it. Now, one of the things that is going on quite regularly is that parents are gifting small sums, maybe a couple of thousand US dollars, actually not that small sums, but by the standards of some of the sums that are mentioned in this study, relatively small sums, are gifting them to their offspring, giving them trading accounts, saying, go and learn to trade. Why? Because it's a necessary skill. No matter early or late, stock trading, you have to learn it. It's part of your kind of liberal business education as a middle-class young Taiwan person is you have to know how to function in the markets. So there's a sense that what's been done here, kind of class, status, all of these sort of things, circuits of capital are being reproduced using these practices and these broking accounts. Again, there's family politics. So this is a traditional idea of private savings within the collective family account. So I mean, we talked about pooling of resources this morning. But oddly enough, this is quite the reverse. When you have a household where everything is traditionally pooled, people carve out their own spaces, which are secret, or at least the amount of them are secret. And they're known as these private savings. And so, indeed, The trading is not discussed in the household precisely because we don't want everyone to know how much money we've got. And again, I think I haven't quite got to the bottom of this. Perhaps these are sort of gendered family politics going on again. You know, the informants talking here are often female. They're being often supported by their mothers. And they're sort of keeping the money out of the range, out of the ambit of the household. And the final thing, again, that makes me think about class and status is this notion of information. And this doesn't mean any information, this is inside information. So we've talked about a lot about calculative strategies, and we see them in kind of European investing, but this seems to be, in the data that I have here, this is what really matters, this kind of information, where people know through their social connections what's going on in the market, whether because there's some manipulation going on, whether because there's a leak or inside information. So this lad in this school, you know, the items which he recommended, He's always went up. He seemed to be able to freeze water by words. What he said would be true, you know. There, and again, these are exclusionary practices, elite practices going on. There's a very interesting quote in the article proper, or a little anecdote about somebody who just as the government is about to announce capital gains back on share trading, which causes a 20-day rout of shares, the telephone rings and her informant says, go and sell everything you have. And indeed, off she does, and she survives this period. So, just to finish up then, in my final minute or so, I suspect, what are we starting to see? Well, the way that money is being treated in these family broking systems is definitely an example of earmarking. We have money that is losable, that's kind of educational, gifted to children, go and learn learn how the markets work, and it doesn't matter if it doesn't come back. It's very much domestic money in the sense of additional salaries, additional income. You know, you're too poor, you need to get rich. There's several stories about wanting extra money on the side, and secret money. And there are all kinds of strategies to blur gifts, favoritism among children, status obligations, and so forth. So, in a sense, exactly what we don't see is this isolation, this extraction, this screams in the spare room. We see family relations worked out in trading. So, just to finish up, we're suggesting that this kind of stock investing is, as Zelitz says, constitutive of the social relations, establishing, maintaining, negotiating, transforming, and terminating impersonal relations.
Thank you. Have some questions. I guess you feel eminently persuaded that when you describe it as relational and about family and position and things like that,
In what sense is it collectivist? In the sense that it is a... I suppose this is relative, and I'm sort of skirting around this a little bit, but the story that you get from investors in the UK says that it's very, very solitary, very, very lonely activity. Here you have, you know, everyone in college is investing, and at break time they all gather around a couple of screens and they participate in this as some kind of, you know, shared endeavour. So I suppose it's not collectivist in the sense that they're sharing funds or anything like that, but it's in terms of the way it's discussed and understood. I don't know. Maybe that's not an appropriate way of. Appropriate way of framing it, but I just—it seems to be a very interesting contrast between the way it works elsewhere in existing literature.
Well, when they're sitting around those screens together, are they all then going into their individual accounts and buying the same stock or selling the same stock?
Well, I suspect that they—I mean, this is what happens when you're using somebody else's data. Of course, is that you're. You're a bit thin around the edges.
Yeah.
But the sense that I've had from talking to you, Haisang, is that they're probably one or two who are trading. And maybe, you know, there's a kind of hierarchy. You have the lad who's a god and who can freeze water with his words, who's at the front, and everybody else is sat round behind watching the graph. So, it's kind of vicarious or participatory or whatever. Whether they go away and trade afterwards, I don't know.
Thanks very much. That was great. You said at the end that complex family relations are worked out in trading. And earlier on, you were talking about the injunction of parents to children that you have to know how to function in the market. And I wondered if we didn't take that quite literally, you have to know how to function in the market, but you have to know how to function in the market, not just the trading market, but if there's a way of taking that more generally. Mm. I wondered what's going on here. It sounds like it's going in two directions, that there's something about what's happening within the domestic sphere with people within families trading kind of in interconnected ways, but that also this is kind of something that's connected to broader social relations beyond the domestic.
If I understand your question correctly, there is very much that sense that learning to trade, because of this kind of bizarre and this ambivalence that the whole practice has between whether it's a game or whether it's business, or so it's sort of seen, I think, as a soft way of getting to grips with business more generally. So I mean, if you're, again, this is the thing that I haven't teased out from the data, is exactly where it came from. But if it's coming from, as I suspect it is, kind of affluent commercial households, then this is a sort of cheap, low-risk bit of business education in senses, that you get out into the markets and you get socialised as an economic agent like that. And I very much in the data, that's the sense of what's going on. There's one girl who is an airline stewardess, so she's got two or three days off in the week regularly. And her mother says, well, don't just sit at home, get trading, you know, because you'll learn something useful. and maybe make a bit of money as well. So I think, in a sense, that there are sort of class relations being worked out through these broking accounts.
Yeah, it's almost like kind of sort of trading knowledge as cultural capital.
Yeah,
socialization,
yeah, exactly.
In some way.
Exactly.
In some ways, it would be interesting to have more detail about Taiwanese society and wealth levels and tax and how it becomes possible that you can have 87 brokerage accounts per 100 population. I mean, you know, in what context is this necessary cultural capital? And, like you say, to be able to sketch out how many of those accounts are concentrated in.
Yeah.
What proportion of households?
There seems to be two stories going on in the data as they're presented, where there's this first one where, like, everybody's in the market. You know, it's like not like in football, if you live in Manchester or something like that, you can't function as a social being. But on the other hand, there's this, you know, this really quite kind of elitist discourse really about education, secret savings, all of these kinds of ideas, which seem to be tied to affluence. So yeah, there's a lot needs fleshing out there.
It's quite a nice metaphor though, in some ways, because you don't have to, like, you know, necessarily be able to play football or even particularly watch football to be able to offer a sort of like, oh yes, you know, they're doing well at the moment, aren't they, kind of comments. And some of the stuff you've said so earlier in the paper about being able to talk about it or know the language, something about how it's kind of conversational.
Absolutely.
A little bit of that quality of it. Any other questions? Okay, well, in that case, let's
thank you very much.
To Piers.